This is Audible.
Fool's Errand. Written by Robin Hobb and read by Nicholas Taylor. Chapter 1. Chade Falstar. Is time the wheel that turns, or the track it leaves behind? Kelstar's Riddle. He came one late, wet spring, and brought the wide world back to my doorstep. I was 35 that year. When I was 20, I would have considered a man of my current age to be teetering on the verge of dotage. These days, it seemed neither young nor old to me, but a suspension between the two. I no longer had the excuse of callow youth, and I could not yet claim the eccentricities of age. In many ways, I was no longer sure what I thought of myself. Sometimes it seemed that my life was slowly disappearing behind me, fading like footprints in the rain, until perhaps I had always been the quiet man, living an unremarkable life, in a cottage between the forest and the sea. I lay abed that morning, listening to the small sounds that sometimes brought me peace. The wolf breathed steadily before the softly crackling hearth fire. I quested towards him with our shared wit magic, and gently brushed his sleeping thoughts. He dreamed of running over snow-smooth rolling hills with a pack. For night eyes it was a dream of silence, cold, and swiftness. Softly I withdrew my touch and left him to his private peace. Outside my small window the returning birds sang their challenges to one another. There was a light wind, and whenever it stirred the trees they released a fresh shower of last night's rain to patter on the wet sward. The trees were silver birches, four of them. They had been little more than sticks when I had planted them. Now their airy foliage cast a pleasant light shade outside my bedroom window. I closed my eyes and could almost feel the flicker of the light on my eyelids. I would not get up. Not just yet. I had had a bad evening the night before and had had to face it alone. My boy, Hap, had gone off gallivanting with Starling almost 3 weeks ago and still had not returned. I could not blame him. My quiet, reclusive life was beginning to chafe his young shoulders. Starling's stories of life at Buckkeep, painted with all the skill of her minstrel ways, created pictures too vivid for him to ignore. So I had reluctantly let her take him to Buckkeep for a holiday, that he might see for himself a spring fest there, eat Caris seed-top cake, watch a puppet show, mayhap kiss a girl. Hap had grown past the point where regular meals and a warm bed were enough to content him. I had told myself it was time. I thought of letting him go, of finding him an apprenticeship with a good carpenter or joiner. He showed a knack for such things, and the sooner a lad took to a trade, the better he learned it. But I was not ready to let him go just yet. However, for now I would enjoy a month of peace and solitude and recall how to do things for myself. Night Eyes and I had each other for company. What more could we need? Yet no sooner were they gone than the little house seemed too quiet. The boy's excitement at leaving had been too reminiscent of how I myself had once felt about spring fests and the like. Puppet shows and Caris seed cakes and girls to kiss all brought back vivid memories I thought I had long ago drowned. Perhaps it was those memories that birthed dreams too vivid to ignore. Twice I had awakened sweating and shaking with my muscles clenched. I had enjoyed years of respite from such unquiet, but in the past 4 years my old fixation had returned. Of late it came and went, with no pattern I could discern. It was almost as if the old skill magic had suddenly recalled me and was reaching to drag me out of my peace and solitude. Days that had been as smooth and alike as beads on a string were now disrupted by its call. Sometimes the skill hunger ate at me, as a canker eats sound flesh. Other times, it was no more than a few nights of yearning, vivid dreams. If the boy had been home, I probably would have shaken off the skill's persistent plucking at me, but he was gone, and so yesterday evening I had given in to the unvanquished addiction such dreams stirred. I had walked down to the sea cliffs, sat on the bench my boy had made for me, and stretched out my magic over the waves. The wolf had sat beside me for a time, his look one of ancient rebuke. I tried to ignore him. No worse than your penchant for bothering porcupines, I pointed out to him.
Save that their quills can be pulled out. What stabs you only goes deeper and festers.
His deep eyes glanced past mine as he shared his pointed thoughts.
Why don't you go hunt a rabbit? You've sent the boy and his bow away.
You could run it down yourself, you know. Time was when you did that.
Time was when you went with me to hunt. Why don't we go and do that instead of his fruitless seeking? When will you accept that there is no one out there who can hear you?
I just have to try.
Why? Is my companionship not enough for you?
It is enough for me. You are always enough for me. I opened myself wider to the wit bond we shared and tried to let him feel how the skill tugged at me. It is the magic that wants this, not me.
Take it away. I don't want to see that.
And when I had closed that part of myself to him, he asked piteously,
Will it never leave us alone?
I had no answer to that. After a time, the wolf lay down, put his great head on his paws and closed his eyes. I knew he would stay by me because he feared for me. Twice the winter before last, I had overindulged in skilling, burning physical energy in that mental reaching until I had been unable even to totter back to the house on my own. Night Eyes had had to fetch Hap both times. This time, we were alone. I knew it was foolish and useless. I also knew I could not stop myself. Like a starving man who eats grass to appease the terrible emptiness in his belly. So I reached out with the skill, touching the lives that passed within my reach. I could brush their thoughts and temporarily appease the great craving that filled me with emptiness. I could know a little of the family out for a windy day's fishing. I could know the worries of a captain whose cargo was just a bit heavier than his ship would carry well. The mate on the same ship was worried about the man her daughter wished to marry. He was a lazy fellow for all of his pretty ways. The ship's boy was cursing his luck. They'd get to Buckkeep Town too late for Springfest. There'd be nothing left but withered garlands browning in the gutters by the time he got there. It was always his luck. There was a certain sparse distraction to these knowings. It restored to me the sense that the world was larger than the four walls of my house, larger even than the confines of my own garden. But it was not the same as true skilling. It could not compare to that moment of completion when minds joined and one sensed the wholeness of the world as a great entity in which one's own body was no more than a mote of dust. The wolf's firm teeth on my wrist had stirred me from my reaching.
Come on, that's enough. If you collapse down here, you'll spend a cold, wet night. I am not the boy to drag you to your feet. Come on now.
I had risen, seeing blackness at the edges of my vision when I first stood. It had passed, but not the blackness of spirit that came in its wake. I had followed the wolf back through the gathering dark, beneath the dripping trees, back to where my fire had burned low in the hearth and the candles guttered on the table. I made myself elf bark tea, black and bitter, knowing it would only make my spirit more desolate, but knowing also that it would appease my aching head. I had burned away the nervous energy of the elf bark by working on a scroll describing the stone game and how it was played. I had tried several times before to complete such a treatise, and each time given it up as hopeless. One could only learn to play it by playing it, I told myself. This time I was adding to the text a set of illustrations to show how a typical game might progress. When I set it aside just before dawn was breaking, it seemed only the stupidest of my latest attempts. I went to bed more early than late. I awoke to half the morning gone. In the far corner of the yard, the chickens were scratching and gossiping amongst themselves. The rooster crowed once. I groaned. I should get up. I should check for eggs and scatter a handful of grain to keep the poultry tamed. The garden was just sprouting. It needed weeding already, and I should reseed the row of fesk that the slugs had eaten. I needed to gather some more of the purple flag while it was still in bloom. My last attempt at an ink from it had gone awry, but I wanted to try again. There was wood to split and stack, porridge to cook, a hearth to sweep, and I should climb the ash tree over the chicken house and cut off that one cracked limb before a storm brought it down on the chicken house itself.
And we should go down to the river and see if any early fish runs have begun yet. Fresh fish would be good.
Night Eyes added, his own concerns to my mental list. Last year you nearly died from eating rotten fish.
All the more reason to go now while they are fresh and jumping. You could use the boy's spear.
And get soaked and chilled?
Better soaked and chilled than hungry.
I rolled over and went back to sleep. So I'd be lazy one morning. Who'd know or care? The chickens? It seemed but moments later that his thoughts nudged me.
My brother, awake. A strange horse comes.
I was instantly alert. The slant of light in my window told me that hours had passed. I rose, dragged a robe over my head, belted it, and thrust my feet into my summer shoes. They were little more than leather soles with a few straps to keep them on my feet. I pushed back my hair from my face. I rubbed my sandy eyes. Go see who it is, I bid Night Eyes.
See for yourself. He's nearly to the door.
I was expecting no one. Starling came thrice or four times a year to visit for a few days and bring me gossip and fine paper and good wine, but she and Hap would not be returning so soon. Other visitors to my door were rare. There was Baylor, who had his cot and hogs in the next vale, but he did not own a horse. A tinker came by twice a year. He had found me first by accident in a thunderstorm when his horse had gone lame and my light through the trees had drawn him from the road. Since his visit, I'd had other visits from similar travellers. The tinker had carved a curled cat, the sign of a hospitable house, on a tree beside the trail that led to my cabin. I had found it, but left it intact, to beckon an occasional visitor to my door. So this caller was probably a lost traveller or a road-weary trader. I told myself a guest might be a pleasant distraction, but the thought was less than convincing. I heard the horse halt outside, and the small sounds of a man dismounting.
"The grey one,"
the wolf growled low. My heart near stopped in my chest. I opened the door slowly as the old man was reaching to knock at it. He peered at me, and then his smile broke forth.
"Fitz, my boy, ah, Fitz!"
He reached to embrace me. For an instant I stood frozen, unable to move. I did not know what I felt. That my old mentor had tracked me down after all these years was frightening. There would be a reason, something more than simply seeing me again. But I also felt that leap of kinship, that sudden stirring of interest that Chade had always roused in me. When I had been a boy at Buckkeep, his secret summons would come at night, bidding me climb the concealed stair to his lair in the tower above my room. There he mixed his poisons and taught me the assassin's trade and made me irrevocably his. Always my heart had beat faster at the opening of that secret door. Despite all the years and the pain, he still affected me that way. Secrets and the promise of adventure clung to him. So I found myself reaching out to grasp his stooping shoulders and pull him to me in a hug. Skinny, the old man was getting skinny again, as bony as he had been when I first met him. But now I was the recluse in the worn robe of grey wool. He was dressed in royal blue leggings and a doublet of the same with slashed insets of green that sparked off his eyes. His riding boots were black leather, as were the soft gloves he wore. His cloak of green matched the insets in his doublet and was lined with fur. White lace spilled from his collar and sleeves. The scattered scars that had once shamed him into hiding had faded to a pale speckling on his weathered face. His white hair hung loose to his shoulders and was curled above his brow. There were emeralds in his earrings and another one set squarely in the center of the gold band at his throat. The old assassin smiled mockingly as he saw me take in his splendor.
"Ah, but a queen's counselor must look the part, if he is to get the respect both he and she deserve in his dealings."
"I see," I said faintly. And then, finding my tongue, "Come in, do come in. I fear you will find my home a bit ruder than what you have obviously become accustomed to, but you are welcome all the same. I did not come to quibble about your house, boy. I came to see you."
"Boy?"
I asked him quietly as I smiled and showed him in.
"Ah, well, to me always, perhaps. It is one of the advantages of age. I can call anyone almost anything I please, and no one dares challenge me. Ah, you have the wolf still, I see. Night eyes, was it? Up in years a bit now, I don't recall that white on your muzzle. Come here now, there's a good fellow. Fitz, would you mind seeing to my horse? I've been all morning in the saddle and spent last night at a perfectly wretched inn. I'm a bit stiff, you know. And just bring in my saddlebags, would you? There's a good lad. He stooped to scratch the wolf's ears, his back to me, confident I would obey him. And I grinned, and did. The black mare he'd ridden was a fine animal, amiable and willing. There is always a pleasure to caring for a creature of that quality. I watered her well, gave her some of the chicken's grain, and turned her into the pony's empty paddock. The saddlebags that I carried back to the house were heavy, and one sloshed promisingly. I entered to find Chade in my study, sitting at my writing desk, poring over my papers as if they were his own. Ah, there you are. Thank you, Fitz. This is the stone game, isn't it? The one Kettle taught you, to help you focus your mind away from the skill road. Fascinating. I'd like to have this when you're finished with it. If you wish, I said quietly. I knew a moment's unease. He tossed out words and names I had buried and left undisturbed. Kettle. The skill road. I pushed them back into the past. It's not Fitz anymore, I said pleasantly. It's Tom Badgerlock. Oh. I touched the streak of white in my hair from my scar. For this, people remember the name. I tell them I was born with the white streak, and so my parents named me. I see, he said noncommittally. Well, it makes sense, and it's sensible. He leaned back in my wooden chair. It creaked. There's brandy in those bags, if you've cups for us. And some of Sarah's ginger cakes. I doubt you'd expect me to remember how fond you were of those. Probably a bit squashed, but it's the taste that matters with those. The wolf had already sat up. He came to place his nose on the edge of the table. It pointed directly at the bags. So Sarah is still cook at Buckkeep? I asked as I looked for two presentable cups. Chipped crockery didn't bother me, but I was suddenly reluctant to set it out for Chade. Chade left the study and came to my kitchen table. Oh, not really. Her old feet bother her if she stands too long. She has a big cushioned chair set up on a platform in the corner of the kitchen. She supervises from there. She cooks the things she enjoys cooking, the fancy pastries, the spiced cakes, and the sweets. There's a young man named Duff does most of the daily cooking now. He was unpacking the saddlebags as he spoke. He set out two bottles marked as Sandsage Brandy. I could not remember the last time I'd tasted that. The ginger cakes, a bit squashed as foretold, emerged, spilling crumbs from the linen he'd wrapped them in. The wolf sniffed deeply, then began salivating. His favourite too, I see, Chade observed dryly, and tossed him one. The wolf caught it neatly and carried it off to devour on the hearthrug. The saddlebags gave up their other treasures quickly. A sheaf of fine paper, pots of blue, red and green inks, a fat ginger root just starting to sprout, ready to be potted for the summer. Some packets of spices, a rare luxury for me, a round, ripe cheese. And in a little wooden chest, other items, hauntingly strange in their familiarity. Small things I had thought long lost to me. A ring that had belonged to Prince Rurisk of the Mountain Kingdom. The arrowhead that had pierced the prince's chest and nearly been the death of him. A small carved box made by my hands years ago to contain my poisons. I opened it. It was empty. I put the lid back on the box and set it down on the table. I looked at him. He was not just one old man come to visit me. He brought all of my past trailing along behind him, as an embroidered train follows a woman into a hall. When I let him in my door, I had let in my old world with him. Why? I asked quietly. Why, after all these years, have you sought me out? Oh, well. Chade drew a chair up to the table and sat down with a sigh. He unstoppered the brandy and poured for both of us. A dozen reasons. I saw your boy with Starling, and I knew at once who he was. Not that he looks like you, any more than Nettle looks like Burrick. But he has your mannerisms, your way of holding back and looking at a thing with his head cocked just so before he decides whether he'll be drawn in. He put me so much in mind of you at that age that...
You've seen Nettle, I cut in quietly. It was not a question.
Of course, he replied as quietly. Would you like to know about her?
I did not trust my tongue to answer.
All my old cautions warned me against evincing too great an interest in her, yet I felt a prickle of foreknowledge that Nettle, my daughter, whom I had never seen except in visions, was the reason Chade had come here. I looked at my cup and weighed the merits of brandy for breakfast. Then I thought again of Nettle, the bastard I had unwillingly abandoned before her birth. I drank. I had forgotten how smooth Sansedge brandy was. Its warmth spread through me as rapidly as youthful lust. Chade was merciful in that he did not force me to voice my interest.
She looks much like you, in a skinny female way, he said, then smiled to see me bristle. But, strange to tell, she resembles Barrick even more.
She has more of his mannerisms and habits of speech than any of his five sons.
Five? I exclaimed in astonishment.
Chade grinned.
Five boys, and all as respectful and deferential to their father as any man could wish, not at all like Nettle. She has mastered that black look of Burrick's and gives it right back to him when he scowls at her, which is seldom. I won't say she's his favourite, but I think she wins more of his favour by standing up to him than all the boys do with their earnest respect. She has Barrick's impatience and his keen sense of right and wrong, and all your stubbornness. But perhaps she learned that from Barrick as well.
You saw Barrick, then. He had raised me, and now he raised my daughter as his own. He'd taken to wife the woman I'd seemingly abandoned. They both thought me dead. Their lives had gone on without me. To hear of them mingled pain with fondness. I chased the taste of it away with Sansedge brandy.
It would have been impossible to see Nettle, save that I saw Barrick also. He watches over her, well, like her father.
He's well. His limp has not improved with the years, but he is seldom afoot, so it seems to bother him little. It is horses with him, always horses, as it always was. He cleared his throat.
You do know that the Queen and I saw to it that both Ruddy and Sooty's colt were given over to him.
Well, he's founded his livelihood on those two stout horses. The mare you unsaddled, Ember, I got her from him.
He trains as well as breeds horses now. He will never be a wealthy man, for the moment he has a coin to spare, it goes for another horse, or to buy more pasturage. But when I asked him how he did, he told me, well enough.
And what did Barrick say of your visit? I asked. I was proud I could speak with an unchoked voice.
Chade grinned again, but there was a rueful edge to it.
After he got over the shock of seeing me, he was most courteous and welcoming. And as he walked me out to my horse the next morning, which one of the twins, Nim, I think, had saddled for me, he quietly promised that he'd kill me before he'd brook any interference with Nettle. He spoke the words regretfully, but with great sincerity.
I didn't doubt them from him, so I don't need them repeated from you.
Does she know Burrick is not her father? Does she know anything of me?
Question after question sprang to my mind. I thrust them away. I hated the avidity with which I had asked those two, but I could not resist. It was like the skill addiction, this hunger to know, finally know these things after all the years.
Chade looked aside from me and sipped his brandy.
I don't know. She calls him Papa.
She loves him fiercely, with absolutely no criticism. Oh, she disagrees with him, but it is about things rather than about Barrick himself. I am afraid that, with her mother, things are stormier. Nettle has no interest in bees or candles, but Molly would like to see her daughter follow her in her trade. As stubborn as Nettle is, I think Molly will have to be content with a son or two instead.
He glanced out of the window. He added quietly, "We did not speak your name when she was present."
I turned my cup in my hands.
"What things do interest her?"
"Horses, hawks, swords. At 15 I expected at least some talk of young men from her, but she seems to have no use for them. Perhaps the woman in her hasn't wakened yet, or perhaps she has too many brothers to have any romantic illusions about boys. She would like to run away to Buckkeep and join one of the guard companies. She knows Burrick was stablemaster there once. One of the reasons I went to see him was to make Katrickan's offer of that position again. Burrick refused it. Nettle cannot understand why. I do. As do I. But when I visited, I told him that I could make a place for Nettle there, even if he chose not to go. She could page for me, if nothing else, though I am sure Queen Katrickan would love to have her. Let her see the way of a keep and a city, let her have a taste of life at court, I told him. Burrick turned it down instantly, and seemed almost offended that I'd offered it. Without intending, I breathed out softly in relief. Che took another sip of his brandy and sat regarding me, waiting. He knew my next question as well as I did. Why? Why did he seek out Burrick, and why did he offer to take Nettle to Buckkeep? I took more of my own brandy and considered the old man. Old, yes, but not as some men get old. His hair had gone completely white, but the green of his eyes seemed to burn all the fiercer beneath those snowy locks. I wondered how hard he fought his body to keep the stoop in his shoulders from becoming a curl, what drugs he took to prolong his vigour, and what those drugs cost him in other ways. He was older than King Shrewd, and Shrewd was all these many years dead, bastard royalty of the same lineage as myself. He seemed to thrive on intrigue and strife, as I had not. I had fled the court and all it contained. Chade had chosen to stay, and make himself indispensable to yet another generation of farseers. So, and how is Patience these days? I chose my question with care. News of my father's wife was well wide of what I wished to know, but I could use his answer to venture closer. Lady Patience? Ah, well, it has been some months since I have seen her. Over a year now that I think of it. She resides at Tradeford, you know. She rules there, and quite well. Odd when you think of it. When she was indeed queen and wed to your father, she never asserted herself. Widowed, she was well content to be eccentric Lady Patience. But when all others fled, she became queen, in fact, if not by title, at Buckkeep. Queen Katrickan was wise to give her a domain of her own, for she never again could have abided at Buckkeep as less than queen. And Prince Dutiful? As like his father as he can be, Chade observed, shaking his head. I watched him closely, wondering how the old man intended the remark. How much did he know? He frowned as he continued. The Queen needs to let him out a bit. The folk speak of Dutiful as they did of your father, Chivalry. Correct to a fault, they say, and almost have the truth of it, I fear. There had been a very slight change in his voice. Almost, I asked quietly. Chade gave me a smile that was almost apologetic. Of late, the boy has not been himself. He's always been a solitary lad, but that goes with being the sole prince. He's always had to keep his position in mind, always had to take care that he was not seen to favour one companion over another. It has made him introspective. But recently he has shifted to a darker temperament. He is distracted and moody, so caught up in his inner thoughts that he seems completely unaware of what is going on in the lives of those around him. He is not discourteous or uncaring, at least not deliberately, but he's, what, 14? I asked. He does not sound so different from Hap of late. I've been thinking much the same things about him, that I need to let him out a bit. It's time he got out and learned something new from someone other than myself. Chade nodded. I think you are absolutely correct. Queen Katrickan and I have reached the same decision about Prince Dutiful. His tone made me suspect I had just run my head into the snare. Oh? I said carefully.
Oh?
Chade mimicked me, and then leaned forward to tip more brandy into his glass. He grinned, letting me know the game was at an end. Oh, yes. You've no doubt guessed it. We would like to have you come back to Buckkeep and instruct the prince in the skill. And Nettle, too, if Burrick can be persuaded to let her go, and if she has any aptitude for it. No, I said the word quickly before I could be seduced. I'm not sure how definitive my answer sounded. No sooner had Chade broached the idea than desire for it surged in me. It was the answer, the so simple answer after all these years.
train up a new coterie of skill users. I knew Chade had the scrolls and tablets relating to the skill magic. Galen, the skill master, and then Prince Regal had wrongfully withheld them from us so many years ago. But now, I could study them. I could learn more, and I could train up others, not as Galen had done, but correctly. Prince Dutiful would have a skilled coterie to aid and protect him, and I would have an end to my loneliness. There would be someone to reach back when I reached out, and both my children would know me, as a person, if not as their father. Chade was as sly as ever. He must have sensed my ambivalence. He left my denial hanging alone in the air between us. He held his cup in both hands. He glanced down at it briefly, putting me sharply in mind of Verity. Then he looked up again, his green eyes meeting mine without hesitation. He asked no questions, he made no demands. All he had to do was wait. Knowing his tactic did not shield me against it. You know I cannot. You know all the reasons I should not. He shook his head, slightly.
Not really. Why should Prince Dutiful be denied his birthright as a Farseer?
More softly, he added.
Or Nettle?
Birthright. I tried for a bitter laugh. It's more like a family disease, Chade. It's a hunger. And when you are taught how to satisfy it, it becomes an addiction. An addiction that can become strong enough eventually to set your feet on the paths that lead past the Mountain Kingdom. You saw what became of Verity. The skill devoured him. He turned it to his own ends. He made his dragon and poured himself into it. He saved the 6 duchies. But even if there had been no red ships to battle, Verity would eventually have gone to the mountains. That place called him. It is the ordained end for any skilled one.
I understand your fears, he confessed quietly. But I think you're wrong. I believe Galen deliberately instilled that fear in you. He limited what you learned, and he battered fear into you. But I've read the skill scrolls. I haven't deciphered all that they tell, but I know it is so much more than simply being able to communicate across a distance. With the skill, a man can prolong his own life and health. It can enhance a speaker's powers of persuasion. Your training. I don't know how far it went, but I'll wager Galen taught you as little as he could.
I could hear the excitement building in the old man's voice, as if he spoke of a hidden treasure.
There is so much to the skill, so much. Some scrolls imply that the skill can be used as a healing tool, not only to find out exactly what is wrong with an injured warrior, but actually to encourage the healing of those hurts. A strong, skilled one can see through another's eyes, hear what the other hears and feels, and...
Chade, the softness of my voice cut him off. I had known a moment of outrage when he admitted he'd read the scrolls. He'd had no right, I'd thought, and then known that if his queen gave them to him to read, he had as much right as anyone. Who else should read them? There was no skillmaster anymore. That line of ability had died out. No, I had killed it. Killed off, one by one, the last trained skill users, the last coterie ever created at Buckkeep. They had been faithless to their king, so I had destroyed them, and the magic with them. The part of me that was rational knew that it was magic better left dead. I am no skill master, Chade. It's not only that my knowledge of the skill is incomplete, but that my talent was erratic. If you've read the scrolls, then I'm sure you've discovered for yourself, or heard from Catrican, that using elf bark is the worst thing a skilled one can do. It suppresses or kills the talent. I've tried to stay away from it. I don't like what it does to me. But even the bleakness it brings on is better than the skill hunger. Sometimes I've used elf bark steadily for days at a time when the craving is bad. I looked away from the concern on his face. Whatever talent I ever had is probably stunted beyond recall now. His voice was soft as he observed. It seems to me that your continued craving would indicate the opposite, Fitz. I'm sorry to hear that you've been suffering. We truly had no idea. I had assumed the skill hunger would be like a man's craving for drink or smoke, and that after a period of enforced abstinence, the longing would grow less.
No,
It does not. Sometimes it lies dormant. Months pass, even years. Then, for no reason I can tell, it stirs to life again. I squeeze my eyes shut for an instant. Talking about it, thinking about it, was like prodding at a boil. Chade, I know that this is why you came all this way to find me, and you've heard me say no. Now can we speak of other things? This conversation pains me. For a time he was silent. There was a false heartiness in his voice when he abruptly said, "Of course we can. I told Cotricken that I doubted you'd fall in with our plan." He gave a brief sigh. "I'll simply have to do the best I can with what I've gleaned from the scrolls. Now, I've had my say. What would you like to hear about? You can't mean that you'll try to teach Dutiful the skill from what you've read in some old scrolls." I was suddenly on the edge of anger. "You leave me no choice," he pointed out pleasantly. "Do you grasp the danger you'd be exposing him to? The skill draws a man, Chade. It pulls at the mind and heart like a lodestone. He will want to be one with it. If the prince yields to that attraction for even an instant whilst he's learning, he'll be gone. And there will be no skilled one to go after him, to pull him back together and drag him from the current." I could tell from the expression on Chade's face that he had no understanding of what I was telling him. He only replied stubbornly, "What I read in the scrolls is that there is danger to leaving one with a strong skill talent completely untrained. In some cases, such youngsters have begun to skill almost instinctively, but with no concept of the dangers or how to control it. I should think that even a little knowledge might be better than to leave the young prince in total ignorance." I opened my mouth to speak, then shut it again. I drew a deep breath and let it out slowly. "I won't be drawn into it, Chade. I refuse. Years ago, I promised myself. I sat by Will and watched him die. I didn't kill him because I'd promised myself I was no longer an assassin and no longer a tool. I won't be manipulated and I won't be used. I've made enough sacrifices. I think I've earned this retirement. And if you and Cotricken disagree with that and no longer wish to provide me with coin, well, I can cope with that as well. As well to have that out in the open. The first time I'd found a bag of coins by my bed after Starling had visited, I was insulted. I'd hoarded the affront for months until she visited me again. She'd only laughed at me and told me that they weren't largesse from her for my services, if that's what I'd thought, but a pension from the 6 duchies. That was when I'd forced myself to admit that whatever Starling knew of me, Chade knew as well. He was the source of the fine paper and good inks she sometimes brought as well. She probably reported to him each time she returned to Buckkeep. I'd told myself it didn't bother me. But now I wondered if all those years of keeping track of me had been Chade waiting for me to be useful again. I think he read my face. "Fitz, Fitz, calm down." The old man reached across the table to pat my hand reassuringly. "There's been no talk of anything like that. We are both well aware of not only what we owe you, but also what the whole 6 duchies owes you. As long as you live, the 6 duchies will provide for you. As for Prince Dutiful's training, put it out of your head. It's not truly your concern at all." Once again, I wondered uneasily how much he knew. Then I steeled myself. "As you say, it's not truly my concern. All I can do is warn you to be cautious." "Ah, Fitz, have you ever known me to be otherwise?" His eyes smiled at me over the rim of his cup. I set it aside, but forbidding myself the idea was like tearing a tree up by the roots. Part of it was my fear that Chade's inexperienced tutelage of the young prince would lead him into danger, but by far the biggest part of my desire to teach a new coterie was simply so that I could furnish myself with a way to satisfy my own craving. Having recognized that, there was no way I could in good conscience inflict this addiction on another generation. Chade was as good as his word. He spoke no more about skilling. Instead, we talked for hours of all the folk I had once known at Buckkeep and what had become of them. Blade was a grandfather, and Lacey was plagued with aching joints that had finally forced her to set her endless tatting aside. Hans was the stable-master at Buckkeep now. He had married an inland woman with fiery red hair and a temper to match. All of their children had red hair. She kept Hans on a short leash, and according to Chade, he seemed only happier for it. Of late she was nagging him to return to Farrow, her homeland, and he seemed prone to obey her. Thus Chade's trip to see Burrick and offer him his old position again. So on and on he peeled calluses away from my memories and brought all the old faces fresh to my mind again. It made me ache for Buckkeep, and I could not forbear to ask my questions. When we ran out of folk to gossip about, I walked him about my place as if we were two old aunties visiting one another. I showed him my chickens and my birch trees, my garden and my walks. I showed him my workshed where I made the dyes and coloured inks that Hap took to market for me. Those at least surprised him. "I brought you inks from Buckkeep, but now I wonder if your own are not the better," he patted my shoulder, just as he once had when I mixed the poison correctly, and the old wash of pleasure at his pride in me rushed through me. I showed him probably far more than I intended. When he looked at my herb beds, he no doubt marked the preponderance of sedatives and painkillers among my drug plants. When I showed him my bench on the cliffs overlooking the sea, he even said quietly, "Yes." Verity would have liked this, but despite what he saw and guessed, he spoke no more of the skill. We stayed up late that night, and I taught him the basics of Kettle's stone game. Night Eyes grew bored with our long talk and went hunting. I sensed a bit of jealousy from the wolf, but resolved to settle it with him later. When we set our game aside, I turned our talk to Chade himself and how he fared. He smilingly conceded that he enjoyed his return to court and society. He spoke to me as he seldom had before of his youth. He'd led a gay life before his mishandling of a potion had scarred him and made him so ashamed of his appearance that he had retreated into a secretive shadow life as the king's assassin. In these late years he seemed to have resumed the life of that young man who had so enjoyed dancing and private dinners with witty ladies. I was glad for him, and spoke mostly in jest when I asked, "But how then do you fit in your quiet work for the crown with all these other assignations and entertainments?" His reply was frank. "I manage, and my current apprentice is proving both quick and adept. The time will not be long before I can set those old tasks completely into younger hands." I knew an unsettling moment of jealousy that he had taken another in my place. An instant later, I recognized how foolish that was. The Farseers would ever have need of a man capable of quietly dispensing the king's justice. I had declared I would no longer be a royal assassin. That did not mean the need for one had disappeared. I tried to recover my aplomb. "Then the old experiments and lessons still continue in the tower?" He nodded once, gravely. "They do, as a matter of fact." He rose suddenly from his seat by the fire. Out of long habit reawakened, we had resumed our old postures, him sitting in a chair before the fire, and me on the hearth beside his feet. Only at that moment did I realize how odd that was, and wonder at how natural it had seemed. I shook my head at myself as Chade rummaged through the saddlebags on the table. He came out with a stained flask of hard leather. "I brought this to show you, and then in all our talk I nearly forgot it. You recall my fascination with unnatural fires and smokes and the like?" I rolled my eyes. His fascination had scorched us both more than once. I refused the memory of the last time I had witnessed his fire magic. He had made the torches of Buckkeep burn blue and sputter on the night Prince Regal falsely declared himself to be the immediate heir of the Farseer crown. That night had also seen the murder of King Shrewd, and my subsequent arrest for it. If Chade made that connection, he gave no sign of it. He returned eagerly to the fireside with his flask. "Have you a twist of paper? I didn't bring any." I found him some and watched dubiously as he took a long strip of my paper, folded it lengthways, then judiciously tapped a measure of powder down the groove of the fold. Carefully he folded the paper over, folded it again, and then secured it with a spiraling twist. "Now, watch this," he invited me eagerly. I watched with trepidation as he set the paper into the fire on the hearth, but whatever it was supposed to do flash or sparkle or make a smoke. It didn't. The paper turned brown, caught fire, and burned. There was a slight stink of sulphur, that was all. I raised an eyebrow at Chade.
"That's not right," he protested, flustered.
Working swiftly, he prepared another twist of paper, but this time he was more generous with the powder from the small flask. He set the paper in the hottest part of the fire. I leaned back from the hearth, braced for the effect, but again we were disappointed. I rubbed my mouth to cover a grin at the chagrin on his face.
"You'll think I've lost my touch," he declared.
"Oh, never that," I responded, but it was hard to keep the mirth from my voice. This time the paper he prepared was more like a fat tube, and powder leaked from it as he twisted it closed. I stood up and retreated from the fireplace as he set it onto the flames, but, as before, it only burned. He gave a great snort of disgust. He peered down the dark neck of the small flask, then shook it. With an exclamation of disgust, he stoppered it.
"Damp got into it somehow. Well, that's spoiled my show."
He tossed the flask into the fire, a mark of high dudgeon for Chade. As I sat back down by the hearth, I sensed the keenness of his disappointment, and felt a touch of pity for the old man. I tried to take the sting from it. "It reminds me of the time I confused the smoke powder with the powdered lancet root. Do you remember that? My eyes watered for hours." He gave a short laugh.
"I do."
He was silent for a time, smiling to himself. I knew his mind wandered back to our old days together. Then he leaned forwards to set his hand to my shoulder.
"Fitz,"
he demanded earnestly, his eyes locking with mine.
"I never deceived you, did I? I was fair. I told you what I was teaching you from the very beginning.
I saw then the lump of the scar between us." I put my hand up to cover his. His knuckles were bony, his skin gone papery thin. I looked back into the flames as I spoke to him. "You were always honest with me, Chade. If anyone deceived me, it was myself. We each served our king and did what we must in that cause. I won't come back to Buckkeep. But it's not because of anything you did, but only because of who I've become. I bear you no ill will for anything." I turned to look up at him. His face was very grave, and I saw in his eyes what he had not said to me. He missed me. His asking me to return to Buckkeep was as much for himself as for any other reason. I discovered then a small share of healing and peace. I was still loved, by Chade at least. It moved me, and I felt my throat tighten with it. I tried to find lighter words. "You never claimed that being your apprentice would give me a calm, safe life." As if to confirm those words, a sudden flash erupted from my fire. If my face had not been turned towards Chade, I suppose I might have been blinded. As it was, a blast, like lightning and thunder together, deafened me. Flying coals and sparks stung me, and the fire roared suddenly like an angry beast. We both sprang to our feet and scrambled back from the fireplace. An instant later, a fall of soot from my neglected chimney put out most of the hearth fire. Chade and I scurried about the room, stamping out the glowing sparks and kicking pieces of burning flask back onto the hearth before the floor could take fire. The door burst open under Night Eye's assault on it. He flew into the room, claws scrambling for purchase as he slid to a halt. "I'm fine, I'm fine," I assured him, and then I realized I was yelling past the ringing in my ears. Night Eye gave a disgusted snort at the smell in the room. Without even sharing a thought with me, he stalked back into the night. Chade suddenly slapped me several times on the shoulder.
"Putting out a coal,"
he assured me loudly. It took us some time to restore order and renew the fire in its rightful place. Even so, he pulled his chair back from it, and I did not sit down on the hearth. "Was that what the powder was supposed to do?" I asked belatedly, when we were resettled with more sansedge brandy.
"No, Els balls, boy. Do you think I'd deliberately do that in your hearth? What I'd been producing before was a sudden flash of white light, almost blinding. The powder shouldn't have done that. Still, I wonder why it did. What was different? Damn."
I wish I could remember what I last stored in that flask. He knit his brows and stared fiercely into the flames, and I knew his new apprentice would be put to puzzling out just what had caused that blast. I did not envy him the series of experiments that would undoubtedly follow. He spent the night at my cottage, taking my bed whilst I made do with Haps, but when we arose the next morning, we both knew the visit was at an end. There suddenly seemed to be nothing else to discuss, and little point to talking about anything. A sort of bleakness rose in me. Why should I ask after folk I'd never see again? Why should he tell me of the current crop of political intrigues when they had no touch on my life at all? For one long afternoon and evening our lives had meshed again, but now, as the grey day dawned, he watched me go about my homely tasks, drawing water and throwing feed to my poultry, cooking breakfast for us and washing up the crockery. We seemed to grow more distant with every awkward silence. Almost I began to wish he had not come. After breakfast he said he must be on his way, and I did not try to dissuade him. I promised him he should have the game scroll when it was finished. I gave him several vellums I had written on dosages for sedative teas, and some roots for starts of the few herbs in my garden that he did not already know. I gave him several vials of different coloured ink. The closest he had come to trying to change my mind was when he observed that there was a better market for such things in Buckkeep. I only nodded, and said I might send Hap there sometimes. Then I saddled and bridled the fine mare and brought her round for him. He hugged me goodbye, mounted, and left. I watched as he rode down the path. Beside me, Night Eyes slipped his head under my hand.
You regret this.
I regret many things, but I know that if I went with him and did as he wishes, I would eventually regret that much more. Yet I could not move from where I stood, staring after him. It wasn't too late, I tempted myself. One shout and he'd turn about and come back. I clenched my jaws. Night Eyes flipped my hand with his nose.
Come on, let's go hunting. No boy, no bows, just you and I.
Sounds good, I heard myself say. And we did, and we even caught a fine spring rabbit. It felt good to stretch my muscles and prove that I could still do it. I decided I was not an old man, not yet, and that I, as much as Hap, needed to get out and do some new things, learn something new. That had always been patience's cure for boredom. That evening, as I looked about my cottage, it seemed suffocating rather than snug. What had been familiar and cozy a few nights ago now seemed threadbare and dull. I knew it was just the contrast between Chade's stories of Buckkeep and my own staid life. But restlessness, once awakened, is a powerful thing. I tried to think when I had last slept anywhere other than my own bed. Mine was a settled life. At harvest time each year, I took to the road for a month, hiring out to work the hayfields or the grain harvest or as an apple picker. The extra coins were welcome. I had used to go into Howes Bay twice a year to trade my inks and dyes for fabric, for clothing and pots and things of that ilk. The last 2 years, I had sent the boy on his fat old pony. My life had settled into routine so deeply that I had not even noticed it.
So, what do you want to do?
Night Eyes stretched and then yawned in resignation. I don't know, I admitted to the old wolf.
Something different. How would you feel about wandering the world for a bit?
For a time, he retreated into that part of his mind that was his alone. Then he asked somewhat testily,
Would we both be afoot, or do you expect me to keep pace with a horse all day?
That's a fair question. If we both went afoot?
If you must.
He conceded grudgingly.
You're thinking about that place. Back in the mountains, aren't you?
The ancient city. Yes. He did not oppose me.
Will we be taking the boy?
I think we'll leave Hap here to do for himself for a bit. It might be good for him, and someone has to look after the chickens.
So I suppose we won't be leaving until the boy comes back.
I nodded to that. I wondered if I had taken complete leave of my senses. I wondered if we would ever come back at all.
Chapter 2. Starling.
Starling Birdsong, minstrel to Queen Katrikan, has inspired as many songs as she has written. Legendary as Queen Katrikan's companion on her quest for elderling aid during the Red Ship War, she extended her service to the Farseer throne for decades, during the rebuilding of the Six Duchies. Gifted with the knack of being at home in any company, she was indispensable to the Queen in the unsettled years that followed the cleansing of Buck. The minstrel was trusted not only with treaties and settlements between nobles, but with offers of amnesty to robber bands and smuggler families. She herself made songs of many of these missions, but one can be sure that she had other endeavours, carried out in secret for the Farseer reign, and far too sensitive ever to become the subject of verse. Starling kept Hap with her for a full 2 months. My amusement at his extended absence changed first to irritation, and then annoyance. The annoyance was mostly with myself. I had not realized how much I had come to depend on the boy's strong back until I had to bend mine to the tasks I delegated to him. But it was not just the boy's ordinary chores that I undertook during that extra month of his absence. Chade's visit had awakened something in me. I had no name for it, but it seemed a demon that gnawed at me, showing me every shabby aspect of my smallholding. The peace of my isolated home now seemed idle complacency. Had it truly been a year since I had shoved a rock under the sagging porch step and promised myself I'd mend it later? No, it had been closer to a year and a half. I put the porch to rights, and then not only shoveled out the chicken house, but washed it down with lye water before gathering fresh reeds to floor it. I fixed the leaking roof on my workshed, and finally cut the hole and put in the greased skin window I had been promising myself for 2 years. I gave the cottage a more thorough spring cleaning than it had had in years. I cut down the cracked ash limb, dropping it neatly through the roof of the freshly cleaned chicken house. I re-roofed the chicken house. I was just finishing that task when Night Eyes told me he heard horses. I clambered down, picked up my shirt, and walked around to the front of the cottage to greet Starling and Hap as they came up the trail. I do not know if it was our time apart or my newly seeded restlessness, but I suddenly saw Hap and Starling as if they were strangers. It was not just the new garb Hap wore, although that accentuated his long legs and broadening shoulders. He looked comical upon the fat old pony, a fact I am sure he appreciated. The pony was as ill-suited to the growing youth as the child's bed in my cottage and my sedate lifestyle. I suddenly perceived that I could not rightfully ask him to stay home and watch the chickens while I went adventuring. In fact, if I did not soon send him out to seek his own fortune, the mild discontent I saw in his mismatched eyes at his homecoming would soon become bitter disappointment in his life. Hap had been a good companion for me. The foundling I had taken in had, perhaps, rescued me as much as I had rescued him. It would be better, far, for me to send this young man out into the world while we both still liked one another, rather than wait until I was a burdensome duty to his young shoulders. Not just Hap had changed in my eyes. Starling was vibrant as ever, grinning as she flung a leg over her horse and slid down from him. Yet, as she came towards me with her arms flung wide to hug me, I realized how little I knew of her present life. I looked down into her merry dark eyes and noted for the first time the crow's feet beginning at the corners. Her garb had become richer over the years, the quality of her mounts better, and her jewelry more costly. Today her thick dark hair was secured with a clasp of heavy silver. Clearly, she prospered. 3 or 4 times a year she would descend on me, to stay a few days and overturn my calm life with her stories and songs. For the days she was there, she would insist on spicing the food to her taste. She would scatter an overlay of her possessions upon my table and desk and floor, and my bed would no longer be a place to seek when I was exhausted. The days that immediately followed her departure would remind me of a country road, with dust hanging heavy in the air, in the wake of a puppeteer's caravan. I would have the same sense of choked breath and hazed vision until I once more settled into my humdrum routine. I hugged her back, hard, smelling both dust and perfume in her hair. She stepped away from me, looked up into my face, and immediately demanded, "What's wrong? Something's different." I smiled, ruefully. "I'll tell you later," I promised, and we both knew that it would be one of our late-night conversations. "Go wash," she agreed. "You smell like my horse." She gave me a slight push, and I stepped... She gave me a slight push,